Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is acclaimed writer, producer, and director Cliff Dorfman, author of the new book, Crime Family. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's a little warm these days, which is supposed to be how it is during the month of July here in the Sonoran Desert where I live. But even in the heat of summer, there are rewards. For example, traffic is much lighter when it's 104 degrees out, since everybody who can leave town does. As we say here in Tucson, it's a dry heat. But of course, so is an oven. Anyway, I hope you're in air-conditioned comfort as you listen to this episode of Too Jewish. We've been exploring the Jewish experience in America over the past few shows in this 250th anniversary of America's Celebration Month. We started 4th of July weekend talking about the origins of the American Jewish community and its relationship to England in colonial times, and particularly during the period of the American Revolution. Last week, we explored some of the important Jewish figures in the early part of America and the beginning of the 19th century, as well as the German Jewish immigration that shaped the form of the Jewish community in the U.S. in those first 80 or 90 years of America. This morning, we'll look at American Jews in the period of the U.S. Civil War, discussing the only anti-Semitic edict ever issued by the federal government or the U.S. military, and look at the foundation of a series of important American Jewish institutions. And then we'll jump to the massive Eastern European Jewish immigration that transformed the Jewish community of America profoundly in the latter stages of the 1800s and on into the 1900s. That is a lot to cover when it's so hot out. We could just sit back in the pool, float around on an air mattress, and sip an iced adult beverage, but no, we Jews believe in hard work, so here we go. At the outbreak of the Civil War, there were about 200 active synagogues in the U.S. The Jewish population in America had reached perhaps 180 or 200,000 in a fast-growing U.S. of about 31 million people. At the time of the Revolutionary War, Jews were just a tenth of 1% of the U.S. population. That had now grown to a still minuscule one-half of 1% of America. About 80% of that population was located in the North. Perhaps 20% lived in the states that seceded to form the Confederacy. During the horrible Civil War, also called the War Between the States, or if you are a Southerner, the War of Northern Aggression, Jews served in both armies and in both governments. There were at least 7 Jewish generals in the Union Army, mostly commanding German Jewish troops, and perhaps 1 in the Confederacy. 7,000 Jews served the Union Army and 3,000 were in the Confederate Army. 3 of my own relatives, by the way, died fighting for the Union. The highest-ranking Jewish figure in the whole Civil War was Judah P. Benjamin, a wealthy lawyer and plantation owner who became an influential U.S. senator from Louisiana before the war. Judah P. Benjamin followed his state into secession and became Confederate President Jefferson Davis's right-hand man. He served in the Confederate cabinet throughout the war as variously Attorney General, Secretary of War, and Secretary of State. Benjamin was widely believed to be the spymaster of the Confederate Secret Service. Even in the face of anti-Semitism, Judah P. Benjamin was quite likely the most powerful man in the Confederate government, with the exception of Jefferson Davis himself. At the end of the war, with the South defeated and the Union victorious, Judah P. Benjamin fled arrest at the hands of the U.S. government, immigrating to England, where, with his fortune and cause lost, he simply started over. Benjamin, of Sephardic Jewish descent, learned English law, became a successful barrister, rose to the top of his profession there, and eventually became such an expert that a textbook he wrote on British common law became the standard in England. The Civil War also produced the only official act of anti-Semitism ever perpetrated by the U.S. government and military. Confusingly, it was promulgated by General Ulysses Grant, who had close Jewish friends before, during, and after the war, including the Jewish merchant and banker Joseph Seligman, whom he later tried to convince to become Secretary of the Treasury in his presidential administration. Now, the troubling incident in question took place in December 1862. Grant was in charge of the Department of Tennessee. Smugglers were actively trying to bring Southern cotton north to sell to merchants. Some of those guys were Jewish. When Grant's manipulative father Jesse brought two Jewish merchants from Cincinnati to his headquarters in order to get him to permit them to buy Southern cotton, Jesse was apparently going to get a 25% cut on the deal. It influenced Grant to issue the dramatic and terrible expulsion order, General Order No. 11, expelling all Jews from the large territory under his military supervision, including Tennessee and parts of Mississippi and Kentucky. Grant's own adjutant and close friend and subordinate, John Rawlins, strongly advised Grant not to issue the order, but Grant insisted. It read, "The Jews as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders are hereby expelled from the department. Within 24 hours from the receipt of this order by post commanders, they will see that all of this class of people be furnished passes and required to leave. Anyone returning after such notification will be arrested and held in confinement until an opportunity occurs of sending them out as prisoners, unless furnished with permit from headquarters." Well, immediately after the order was issued, all the Jews at Holly Springs, Mississippi, Grant's supply depot, were rounded up and forcibly removed. Some Jewish traders were forced to evacuate 40 miles on foot. On December 28th, Grant's order was fully enforced at Paducah, Kentucky. 30 Jewish families, shell-shocked and roughly treated by the military, were ordered to leave Paducah within 24 hours. Jewish families in Paducah were forced to collect their personal belongings, shutter their homes and shops, and board a steamer on the Ohio River. One Jewish resident of Paducah, a man named Caesar Caskell, a Union loyalist and president of the Paducah Union League Club, was summoned to Paducah's provost marshal and ordered to leave the city. Jews immediately protested the expulsion all the way to President Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, was a lawyer himself. He studied the documents Grant issued expelling Jews. Lincoln had consistently supported and promoted Grant. But after reading the document, the president told General-in-Chief Henry Halleck to have Grant revoke General Order No. 11. Halleck did it in the following message. "A paper purporting to be General Orders No. 11 issued by you December 17th has been presented here. By its terms, it expels all Jews from your department. If such an order has been issued, it will be immediately revoked." And 3 weeks after being issued, Grant revoked it. By just a narrow margin, Grant avoided being censured by the U.S. House of Representatives for having issued the anti-Jewish order at all. That incident, terrible as it was, proved to be the exception that, well, proves the rule. The U.S. had not previously and has not again instituted an anti-Semitic law throughout the 250 years of its national history. Grant went on to appoint more Jews to the federal government when he became president and to higher offices than any previous president. So, back to the organization of the Jewish community that took place in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War and subsequent decades. Since so many German Jews had immigrated to the U.S., it should come as no surprise that the form American Judaism took in the middle of the 19th century was heavily influenced by that. Reform Judaism began as the first modern movement in Judaism at all in Germany in the early 1800s. It soon migrated to America along with some of its adherents. Led by a dynamic rabbi from Germany named Isaac Meir Wise, a series of institutions were created that helped the rapidly growing network of Reform synagogues, rabbis, and Reform Jews to organize. Hebrew Union College ordained rabbis. The Central Conference of American Rabbis was a professional and still is organization of these religious leaders. The Union of American Hebrew Congregations brought the synagogues together. For a while, it looked like American Judaism was simply going to be Reform Judaism. That all changed for two significant reasons. First, in ordaining the first class of rabbis ever from the Hebrew Union College in the year 1883, the elaborate event featured a menu that was far from kosher. It included shrimp, meat, and milk, and a number of dishes that have given it the eternal name of the Trefa Banquet. That means not kosher. The more traditional rabbis celebrating the ordination of the very first American-trained rabbis certainly knew they had no place in this less observant movement. They went out and founded the conservative movement in the 1880s. Of even more significance for American Jewry was the huge immigration beginning at about the same time of Jews from Europe, only this time not German Jews, but what are often called Russian Jews. Essentially, Jews from the Russian Empire, from Poland, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, Lithuania, the eastern parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and so on. By and large, these Jews had no knowledge of the reforms that had swept Jewish Germany in the early 1800s and mid-1800s. They were more traditional in practice. They wanted to be Americans, of course, so that meant they were probably not going to remain Orthodox forever. And the only options in most of the countries they were emigrating from had been Orthodox or nothing. But reform was a bridge too far for most of them. Gradually, they migrated mostly to the conservative movement, rapidly swelling its ranks. The truth is, the scope of this migration of Eastern European Ashkenazic Jews overwhelmed the existing Jewish organizations and created many of its own. In the period between the 1880s and the outbreak of World War I in 1914, about 2 million primarily Yiddish-speaking Ashkenazic Jews immigrated to the U.S. When you remember there were only about 180,000 Jews in America at all 20 years before this immigration, the arrival of these new American Jews represented a change of incredible magnitude. We'll talk about that next week here on Too Jewish as we continue to explore the Jewish experience in America over this 250th anniversary month. And so to play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a sample of German Jewish music you might have heard in a German Jewish synagogue in America, provided it was Temple Emmanuel in New York or Emmanuel in San Francisco or any of the Emmanuels. It's called Uvenucha Yomar for the Torah service by composer Louis Lewandowski, sung by cantors Ozzy Schwartz and Mira Davis. Mahazikim Abba Vetomechea Meushal Derachea Darcheinoan Vechol Netivote Shalom. was Vinucho Yomar by Louis Lewandowski, a classic composition of German Jewish music. When we return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guest this morning will be Cliff Dorfman, who learned something extraordinary and disturbing about his own background and integrated it into his new novel, Crime Family. Hear all about it. We come back in a moment on Two Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Cliff Dorfman is an acclaimed screenwriter of films like Warrior and an award nominee for writing on Entourage, a show many of us recall. He has a new novel out. It's called Crime Family, which is pretty Jewish and complicated. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Sam. How are you?
I'm good. You know, we were talking before we went on the air, and I had to say, while there's many Jewish characters in this book, I don't really want to meet any of them.
Well, I agreed with you, though I would say, wouldn't you want to meet Maya Lansky if you can meet anybody?
Yeah, provided, you know, there was like bulletproof glass between us or something. Maya Lansky is the guy I would want to meet. I don't want to meet Bugsy Siegel or Dutch Schultz or any of those guys. Tell us what prompted Crime Family.
Well, I was adopted from the Louise Wise Agency and a part of that Neubauer twin study, and that sort of prompted this wanting to know how it affected me. And the only way I could really do that and see that through was through this sort of world of fiction in this Jewish crime family being raised in Long Island, coming out to Hollywood, coming back. So it became this cathartic way to tell the story.
You know, I sometimes think that's how most novelists start, that there's just a lot of autobiography mixed in and self-exploration. You mentioned, of course, your adoption into, was it a modern Orthodox family?
Yes. It was a modern Orthodox family in Merrick, Long Island.
I will say, having spent time in Orthodox cheders as a kid, as a blue-eyed blonde kid, but not adopted, I can tell you, anybody who looks at all different, like there's a definite sensitivity to any kind of difference. I guess that's true of all people, but I think it's particularly acute in the Orthodox world.
Yeah, that really secular, no outsiders.
Yeah, I mean, and even if you're doing all the right stuff, you're still kind of an outsider if you don't quite fit. Tell us how you developed this book besides your own story.
Well, you know, the plot obviously is fiction, you know, but the emotional truth, it's deeply, deeply personal. It's, you know, like I said, feeling like an outsider. I always felt sort of like this perennial outsider, and I had this thought, you know, no family is perfect. Every family has secrets. Right. And but how do I kind of do an autopsy on that part of the human condition, feeling like an outsider, yet having secrets to keep, being in this very insular community and really being the perfect example of, you know, studying nature versus nurture, especially being half Jewish and on the mother's side and then half Delano Roosevelt on my father's side, biological.
Wow. Yeah, it's quite a background. So the Neubauer study, obviously, not only in your life, but it's pivotal to the book. It's crazy to us today. Tell us more about it.
Well, they were taking, it was Dr. Peter Neubauer, and he was on the board at Louise Wise, as well as a member of the National Institute of Health.
Right, and Louise Wise, sorry to interrupt you, but Louise Wise is the famous adoption service, right?
Yes, it was the Louise Wise Services, I think it was. It was the premier adoption agency for Jewish people, especially on the Upper East Side and in Manhattan and in any affluent section of Long Island or the East Coast, really. If you wanted a Jewish baby, you went to Louise Wise. Little did we know that him and a woman, Dr. Viola Davis, were conducting an illegal human experiment on the babies to study nature versus nurture. And they were separating twins and triplets with no knowledge given to anyone. And they locked up these studies in the Yale Library until 2065. I guess Neubauer wanted to make sure he was dead and the majority of us were dead before, you know, so nobody tried to kill him.
Incredible. We will talk much more with that and how that plays into the story of Crime Family. We come back in a moment here on Too Jewish with Cliff Dorfman. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established over 7 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests. Always call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious School is registering kids now for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Torah Tikes experience, Hebrew School, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are always open to everybody. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. and services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Come on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson, if you can't get here in person. All of our musical services are available in person and virtually. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those by going to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, when I started when we started Too Jewish, and you were there at the start, some 23 years ago or so, more, anti-Semitism was a declining and almost disappearing element in American Jewish life. The late Len Dinnerstein of blessed memory, whose famous book was Anti-Semitism in America, was one of my first guests, founder of the Judaic Studies Program at the University of Arizona, and he said, I don't know what people are so worried about. There's less anti-Semitism now than in my whole life. It's gone the opposite direction in the last nearly quarter century. Is it just a recurrence of this ancient, oldest form of racist hatred, or is there something else going on?
Well, it's a lot of things, but first I want to circle back to something you said right at the beginning, which is like 25 years ago, anti-Semitism was practically non-existent. You can only say that if you didn't go to Harvard. Okay?
Yes.
Because those of us who did knew that in the last quarter of the last century, anti-Semitism was alive and well at Harvard. And there's a certain irony in the fact that Harvard now has not only a Jewish president, but a distinguished alumnus of Camp Ramon, Wisconsin, my home summer camp, where I spent many summers first as a camper, then as a staff member, then as a senior member of the administration. So Alan Garber is doing a terrific job. But anti-Semitism is so deeply entrenched in Harvard and its traditions. Now, Harvard doesn't have fraternities, for example. It has something called the Finals Club. But it was very clear to me when I was there that if you were Jewish, you couldn't join a Finals Club, even if you wanted to. It was just like, there was no question. And there were other manifestations as well, you know, people who would schedule their final exams on Yom Kippur or whatever. I mean, it's just like, and some of it maybe was just thoughtlessness and not vicious, intentional anti-Semitism. But socially, you know, to be really one of the cool people at Harvard, you had to have gone to a New England private school, and you had to have a Roman numeral at the end of your name, preferably 4 or higher.
Right. And it helped to have a last name as a first name, Chandler or something like that.
Right. I had a colleague in the Foreign Service whose first name was Outerbridge. I had another colleague whose first name was Price.
Yeah.
Conversations between him and me were very confusing.
I can see the problem.
Anyway, to get back to your question, I think that a big factor in the modern history of anti-Semitism, let's say over the past 50 years or so, has been the fact that many people around the world, either willfully or just out of pure ignorance, don't really distinguish between Jewish and Israeli. So, you know, in their mind, this is obviously factually incorrect. Every Israeli is a Jew. Not true, factually. And every Jew is either an Israeli or a wannabe Israeli whose primary loyalty lies with Israel. And these are persistent beliefs that cause many people all over the world, not just Muslims, not just ignorant, illiterate people in developing countries, but all over the world on every level of society, to confuse Jewish and Israeli. And in the first 20 years of its existence, the State of Israel did a remarkably good job of, I wouldn't say exactly propaganda, let's call it public relations.
What they call Hasbara.
Right, what they call Hasbara, which is actually explanation. But they were very good at that. They had a well-honed machine. They made sure to be represented at meetings like the Socialist International, whatever. They were like, Israel was largely in Northwestern Europe seen as a progressive, socialist-leaning country with a lot of the ideals of kibbutzim, like written into its non-existent constitution. Then that changed. After the Yom Kippur War, which was a dismal failure of Israeli military and foreign policy, Israel seems to have neglected, shall we say, to put it nicely, or attached less priority to its mission of Hezbollah. So the public relations declined quickly. And the normative view of Israel around the world changed from being a progressive socialist country to a repressive apartheid country with surprising rapidity. Now, that might speak to the ancient hatred of anti-Semitism and the ancient prejudice against Jews, the rapidity with which that image changed. And so, you know, it was like not even the next day after the events of October 7th, when people around the world were portraying this as purely Israel's fault, that somehow the Jews were to blame for this horrible massacre that occurred. And obviously for us, that view was very disparate with our own feelings that we've been victimized, like once again, in the worst massacre of Jews since the end of the Holocaust.
And somehow that becomes our fault.
Yes. Well, so the world quickly normalized the version of Israel committed genocide, and you know, lots of people who I would never have suspected of being anti-Semitic in countries like France, Germany, Poland, Turkey, people who are Jews in their own family, were suddenly openly talking about Jews in a different way, and there were plenty of willing partners to promote those viewpoints, and sometimes overtly, sometimes covertly, but there was a lot of help and a lot of deep pockets behind getting those views accepted almost universally. And those views invariably lead to incidents of violent anti-Semitism.
Tom, we will talk next week. Tough subject, but an important one.
Okay, I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A young Jewish man excitedly tells his mother he's fallen in love and is going to get married. He says, "Just for fun, Ma, I'm bringing over 3 women. You try to guess which one I'm going to marry." His mother reluctantly agrees. The next day, he brings 3 beautiful women into the house and sits them all down on the couch, and they chat with his mother for a while. He then says, "Okay, Ma, guess which one I'm going to marry." Immediately, his mother replies, "The redhead in the middle." "That's amazing, Ma," says her son. "You're right. How did you know?" And the mother says, "Her, I don't like." Truly a classic. That was the Old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature of Too Jewish, Just for You, You Should Live and Be Well. And now a word of Torah. You may be familiar with the most important text in this week's portion of Vayetchanan. For most Jews, it's the first Hebrew words they ever learn. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Commentaries on the Shema focus on the word Echad, one, that core idea of our belief in one God, monotheism itself. But perhaps the most interesting word in the Shema is not the word Echad, one, but the first word, Shema. So what does Shema really mean? Essentially, it means listen, or since it's in the Tzivui, the command form of Hebrew, it means listen up, pay attention, hear what is about to be said. So why was it necessary to order the Israelite people to listen? Of course, if everybody was always listening, we'd never have to command it. No one insists people pay attention when they're already doing so. This is a verbal effort to grab the wandering focus of the Israelites and get them to hear what's about to be said. Listen, pay attention. This is important. And with the Jewish people, that is never unnecessary. It's crucial. The next commandment after the command Shema, listen, is Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God. First we're told to listen and then to love. Fascinating. The first listen is a command we can easily perform. We can be compelled to listen, I suppose. But how can anybody be commanded to love? Love, by definition, is voluntary. It must be given freely, generously, instinctively, emotionally, or it's not love at all. The great Jewish theologian Franz Rosenzweig said, "Of course, love cannot be commanded. No third party can command it or extort it." So, how is it possible for God to command us to love in this central Jewish statement? The answer is right here in the familiar words of the Shema. We are being commanded to listen because if we truly listen, we cannot help but love. There is something precious, beautiful, and sacred about listening that allows us to love. Without listening, we human beings aren't capable of love. For love to exist, we must listen to the other person, not just their words or their joys, but their feelings, their pain, their inner messages. It's only through listening we find out what makes their lives meaningful and come to understand and truly love them. This week is also Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation after the commemoration of Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, our remembrance of the destruction of both temples. The great prophet 2 Isaiah begins the Haftarah for this week, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, be comforted, my people. So how does God comfort the people in this time of catastrophe? Well, Isaiah promises repeatedly that God has heard the people's pain. And since God has listened, it is absolutely certain that God loves the people and will relieve their pain. At times of great loss, often the only comfort comes from knowing someone is really listening and can therefore supply the love that we all need to survive. We know that our relationship with God is supposed to mirror our relationships with each other. The book of Leviticus, earlier in the Torah, has already commanded us to love other people. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now here in Deuteronomy, the Torah tells us to love God. There's a great lesson in this sequence, for only after we learn to listen to others and love them can we come to listen to God and so love God. Only after we teach ourselves to listen can we truly love. This week, may we remember to listen to those around us and so affirm our love for them and therefore for God. When we return in a moment on Two Jewish, our guest, Cliff Dorfman, explains what it's like to write about a challenging family situation that hits close to home and yet still create a compelling novel. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
A slight majority of House Democrats who voted last week backed Republican Representative Thomas Massie's amendment to cut military aid to Israel. Even the party's leaders split their votes. It was the first time a majority of Democratic members of the House had voted to deny military aid to Israel, and it marked a dramatic break with the bipartisan support Israel has enjoyed in the U.S. Congress for many years. The amendment, of course, was soundly defeated. It got no support from Republicans, with the exception of its sponsor, Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky, an anti-Semitic lame duck maverick, to mix our animal metaphors, who has made his disagreement with the Republican Party on Israel his signature issue. A number of progressive groups pointed to the widespread support among Democrats as a sign the U.S.-Israel relationship is in need of fundamental change. This is a moment that signifies an end to the era of paying lip service to the need to change the reality in the region, the liberal Jewish Middle East policy group J Street wrote. But the amendment, which proposed cutting $3.3 billion in military aid to Israel, also drew support from moderate Democrats who have a long record of supporting Israel, like Representative Nancy Pelosi and Representative Jake Auchinloss of Massachusetts. In total, 103 Democrats voted in favor, 98 voted against, another 10 abstained. There are 212 Democrats currently sitting in the House. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York opposed the amendment. He did call, however, for a change in direction in the American-Israeli relationship. Representative Catherine Clark of Massachusetts, the minority whip and the party's second-ranking House member, supported it. The vote is the latest reflection of how American military support for Israel has plunged in popularity among Democratic voters and their representatives. Earlier this year, all but seven Senate Democrats voted in favor of a Bernie Sanders-led resolution to block certain weapons sales to Israel. Massie's amendment received broader support than the separate Block the Bombs Act, which would prohibit the sale of certain weapons to Israel, and has gradually gained support among House Democrats. 77 of them now co-sponsor it. Both the Democratic Majority for Israel and the Republican Jewish Coalition celebrate the amendment being blocked. The House was right to reject Representative Thomas Massie's reckless amendment. It would have weakened Israel, emboldened Iran and its terrorist proxies, and undermined American security interests, the Democratic Majority for Israel said. In its response, the Republican Jewish Coalition criticized the Democratic Party, writing, "Vociferous hostility to Israel is not the fringe, it is their future." In contrast, it said, "Make no mistake, Thomas Massie is voice of one in the Republican Party." That's accurate. He was the only Republican to vote in favor of the amendment. The other 215 voted against. "He is a lame duck outlier. The Republican majority left no doubt about where our party stands resolutely with the Jewish state," the Republican Jewish Coalition said. A handful of progressive challengers with sharply critical Israel stances have won Democratic congressional primaries during this year's midterms. The Institute for Middle East Understanding Policy Project, a pro-Palestinian terrorist advocacy group, warned that Democrats who voted against Massie's amendment would face challengers down the road. And a Democrat who continues to stand with AIPAC's fringe agenda of funding to Israel and against their voters on the moral issue of our time is inviting a primary challenge, the group said. New York Representative Pat Ryan, notably a moderate, wrote he voted in support of the amendment and that he does not want AIPAC's endorsement and would return its money. A number of Democrats put out statements saying they voted in favor of the amendment, but we continue to support subsidies for defensive weapons. Massie's amendment did not target the $500 million designated for missile defense programs like the Iron Dome. J Street did not support the amendment, calling it overly broad, a poorly drafted political stunt designed to divide Democrats, which, of course, it did. Nonetheless, the group wrote, it welcomed House Democratic leadership taking a stronger stance on using U.S. leverage to pressure the Israeli government to change course. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Cliff Dorfman, has written a fascinating novel, Crime Family. Rough on the edges, but it, you know, if you like something with some grit to it, and you should, it's a terrific book. Cliff is a very successful screenwriter who has moved on to novels. So we talked a little bit about the Louise Wise Adoption Agency, about the Neubauer study. The thing that occurs to me is the Jewish families were all using this adoption agency, which was employing only somewhat gentler version of like Nazi eugenics almost. I mean, it feels so awful.
The irony is, well, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's exactly what I wanted to highlight. Like the irony is extraordinary.
Well, yeah. And the irony also is that Dr. Neubauer himself escaped the Nazis. I think it was in Switzerland. And
right.
Then he went on to, you know, for lack of a better term, I'll say emulate their, you know, studies. Basically, and inflict them on us.
I think people tend to think that the Jews of America are all Ashkenazic Jews of one background. That's one of the interesting things that comes out of your book is you play on a lot of those Jewish themes.
Yes.
You know, tell us a little bit about how you developed that familiarity and how you worked it into the book.
Well, you know, growing up modern Orthodox, you know, and having, you know, the Ashkenazi was very prevalent, but in my synagogue, which was Olaf Shalom in Merrick, there were not just, you know, we had just as many Sephardic Jews as we had Ashkenazi, and then I had spent several summers with Beitar. I don't know if you're familiar with that organization.
Sure.
The Likud party organization.
Yeah.
So I would spend summers as like a teen tour in Israel, and we had family in Kiryat Ono outside of Tel Aviv, and so I was, you know, we were staying at kibbutzes, in moshavs, and in military bases. So I had been given a, to quote, paraphrase, Sex in the City, a veritable poo-poo platter of the different types of Jewish people and beliefs, you know, Shabbat versus Shabbos.
Right.
You know, even saying that, you know, an Israeli, why are you saying that? You know, they say it like this, and you go, oh, okay, like, I didn't realize there were, you know, multiple ways, and even in the belief systems, and obviously in the cultural way that they would treat each other, and they would even refer to each other, I felt like this is just a fascinating place to dive in, because what says the human condition more than, you know, secular things being even more secular?
The family dynamics in the book are very interesting. Messed up, I would say.
Yeah.
How, do they mirror your own, or is that an invention?
Well, you know, it's like I said, the emotional truth is deeply personal. Oscar Wilde said, you know, be yourself because everyone else is already taken. And I am a big subscriber to that belief. So, yeah, they mirror my family dynamics. Without a doubt, because this had to be sort of a cathartic way to get through certain secrets and truths in my family that, you know, I had to plow through. And as a writer, it's really the best form of therapy we have.
You write about being a writer in here also, of course. You've had experience. Why the shift for you between writing for movies and TV and working on a novel?
Well, I had done, you know, film and television. I had written for many different magazines. I had a column in a magazine for a while called Cliff's Notes. I had written for DC Comics and Heavy Metal Magazine, so I covered that medium. And this is not to, you know, make myself bigger in any way. This is to say I had kind of covered all these mediums, you know, film, television, video games, comic books, magazines and columns, and I felt I always wanted to write a novel. There was that deep kind of seated, how do I do this? What can I do this on? And I started multiple novels, all of which were complete garbage, because there was never a reason to write them. And then this, you know, event in my life happened with my family, and I had found these text messages that I wasn't supposed to see, and it prompted this immediate light bulb where the writer bell goes off and you're like, this is what I'm writing. And the next thing I knew, it was, you know, 100 pages, 150 pages, and then, you know, Scott Kaufman at Buchwald, my agent, was selling it, and all of a sudden I had a deadline, and I was like, holy, like, this is a novel now. This is written. And it flowed out of me. I always think it's, and I use this term in the book a lot, I always think it's Hashem who, you know, gives us these things. It's we're a channel and a vessel to kind of bring these things forth into the world.
The novel itself and the way it sort of evolves, you know, it explores, it, you know, it starts with that, the great trauma, and then works its way out. I guess I want to go back to the facts of the story. As you said, they wanted it sealed for like a century. What broke that omerta? What broke that secrecy on the twin study, the triplet study?
An absolutely amazing and riveting documentary, Three Identical Strangers, broke it wide open. A guy in Long Island who kept hearing that he had a double. He had a twin. He had a doppelganger. I saw you at the Mets game. I saw you at the mall. And he's like, what the heck? Like, where do you see me? And he did this investigation. Have you seen that documentary?
No, I haven't. But I will now.
Can't recommend it highly enough. It's and it broke it wide open. And all of this came out. And then suddenly I was like, oh my God, am I, you know, like I was in those years of being adopted. And then Louise Wise dissolved. And I had to call a number and then leave all my information. They had to verify that I was a part of the study. Once they verified, it was a couple of weeks later, I got a call back from, I guess, a law office, and I had to reiterate my information, answer some more questions, then I had to wait and find out what it was. So that's kind of how that sparked. So I didn't find out I was a part of the study until much later in life. I knew I was adopted from very early on.
But you didn't know all about this twin study and the rest of it. Wow. I don't know how one moves on from something like this, except maybe by writing this novel.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you asked the question about, you know, like film versus novelist. It's like film is collaborative, right? Like there's no, even if you're an auteur in film, you got 200, 300, 400 people who are, you know, you're not making it in a vacuum. But the novel is personal. It lets you, and for me, it let me live inside Chase's head, our lead character, and kind of explore emotion in ways that just film is incapable of doing because of the personal nature of the writing style.
The Hollywood aspect to it, and there's plenty of Hollywood in the book. How careful did you have to be not to make it recognizable, people?
You know, good question. We truncate the best characters, right, and the worst characters into these hopefully not just broad archetypes. I tried to mix it up enough, and we did this in Entourage a lot. You know, we would make these characters like, I kind of know who that is, but are you talking about this person? And what's that novel? Is it See Sammy Run? Are you familiar with that book about Hollywood?
No.
I think it was from the 40s.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's an old book. Yes, of course. Okay.
Yes, but that was a big influence for me in Entourage and in touching on the Hollywood here, which is, you know, the author always had these questions like, who was this? Who was this? And he would never tell. And it actually, you know, deepened the intrigue to it. So I tried to fashion my characters after that idea. So that book became a big influence in how I created these characters because that author was always being asked, who's Sammy based on? And, you know, how did you do? Is it this person? And he would never tell. And I said, you know, for Entourage and especially for this book, we have to use that iceberg theory where there's enough on the surface that it seems real, and then there's way much deeper underneath where people go, I know that person, but I'm never going to tell. And so that's kind of how I fashioned it. And then, of course, there's many real-life examples. You know, you can't be in Hollywood as long as I've been in Hollywood and not have real characters to base these on.
It's funny because crime family, you don't think Hollywood family. It does make you wonder a little bit. When you were creating when you were writing Crime Family, did you know where you were going with it when you started?
Yes, I always had a strong idea of where this story was going to end. You know, especially when you're dealing with an antagonist who is a malignant narcissist, you have to realize, and this is life, you know, you're never going to get that resolve that you would have in a film, for example, where, you know, I got the person. They realized what they did, and they said, you know what? You're right. So once you know that, you go, okay, well, then how am I going to resolve this story? And that was really the cathartic part, which was finding out how Chase could resolve within himself all of this trauma, generational, institutional rot, to get to a place where it wasn't about them realizing that they did wrong. It was about Chase realizing that he had to be okay with it. And it's not the, you know, you can't really get that in film.
That is interesting. I mean, I think in some independent films you get something like that, like acceptance at the end. But it doesn't show up that way in a Hollywood production much, does it?
No. No, you definitely don't have that freedom. Again, why the novel?
Yeah. Is there a movie in this book?
I mean, I think so. I think there's a TV series. We've actually partnered, I'm not allowed to say with who, but with a very big director production company in Hollywood that is now developing the TV.
The streaming series based on it.
Yes.
The basic shock value, which I wouldn't say you give it away early, but, you know, it's clear from the beginning of the book that's going to be pivotal because it's crucial. I think it's such an amazing and terrible story that, you know, it has to be told. As you said, it's been told in this documentary, but that's not quite the same reach as a streaming series might have. So mazel tov that it's being developed.
Thank you very much.
What percentage of shows that are developed in development actually make it to the screen?
The real answer, if I'm being generous, 3%.
Okay. Well, that's actually more than I thought, for that matter.
Well, I said if I'm being generous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we should be generous. It's tzedakah, right? It's, you know.
Yes.
What was your favorite part about writing the book?
That's a great question. So I would say it might be a bit of a broader answer than one would expect, but in everything else I had written, I had, you know, had these where I've lived inside, you know, the movie or the TV show or even the comic book per se. But I had never had the opportunity, like I did with this book, to create basically a hallucinatory reality that I packed up all my stuff and moved into and lived in for the duration of writing this book. I would wake up in the morning and I would be like as Cliff, and I would be sad that I wasn't Chase and involved in a relationship with this wonderful woman, Kendra.
Right.
You know, and you know, so I got to create this hallucinatory reality that what I had, you know, strived for is that the reader will get to also pack up their stuff and move in and live there with me during the reading of this book.
It's great. I want to thank Cliff Dorfman for a really fun visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Crime Family. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
Oh, you can order you can pre-order the book now. It comes out July 21st through Post Hill Press and Simon & Schuster. You can get it on Amazon and you can get it on Barnes & Noble. And please pre-order and order. I think everyone's going to enjoy it.
I would agree. Cliff, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be David Breithman, CEO of the Jewish Education Project, author of the new book, Heroism and Hope, Recharging Israel Education in a Post-October 7th World. And please, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, for our service and class schedule and to sign up for our wonderful new Torah Tykes membership. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Israel, the recent hit Ahava Rishona, First Love. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
עבדתי לילות במחסן מאובק, את חזרת בבוקר עם ריח מרוחק, הכרטיס האשראי הופיע מלון, ושמחר חתם לידך על חשבון. אהבה ראשונה, כמה זה קרה.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. שני מאבד, לא כל חיים.